The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with us here, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're @NewstalkScience, and we get to all of your comments at the end of the podcast. Coming up on this week's episode, we speak to a woman who's written a book that, look, there's no way to sugarcoat it, it's hugely depressing. It's about fertility rates in 2021 across the world, why they're in such decline and what we can do about it. We'll be speaking to author of Countdown, Shanna Swan. It is a sobering subject. So let's start with something a little bit lighter and look back at the week's science news as we tend to do. Joining us via Skype is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from anyway, Galway, Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. You're both very welcome. Jessamine, you have a Bright Club coming up, do you not?
That's right. We have another Bright Club where we're looking at science, comedy, all the things intersecting those two and more topics next Tuesday on April 13th. So it's going to be, again, online for Zoom, which means you can log in from anywhere. And we're going to be talking about science, philosophy, museums. And we have the wonderful Colm O'Regan headlining. So it's going to be a great show if people want to look it up. There's tickets available and more information on brightclub.ie.
All right. Our first story.
Scotty. I can't change the laws of physics. I've got to have 30 minutes.
Is it's an interesting one, Shane, because it seems like physicists are really excited about this, but they're also cautious that, you know, they don't want to overhype it. So it's this sort of weird, stilted announcement that we may have destroyed physics as we know it, but we don't know yet. So tell us exactly what happened.
Yeah, physics and headlines don't go together because the way scientific knowledge is established is through consensus. Like, rarely would you see a headline that's consensual or, you know, kind of moving in that direction. Anyway, I digress. So 2 weeks ago, we reported news from CERN that described the decay, the unusual decay of a subatomic particle called the meson. And it didn't agree with the standard model, which is the kind of the blueprint for how much of physics works. And we kind of hinted that, you know, there was cautious optimism from physicists that maybe they were going to have new physics. And I feel like it's a bit, I don't know if it's a coincidence, but 2 weeks later, we're getting news from the other side of the Atlantic, from Fermilab, that they have, in a separate experiment, found data that is also inconsistent with the standard model. So here's two things having a go at this absolute, like, keystone in physics. But a keystone that we know isn't complete. So the standard model is great, but it is not complete.
Yeah, it's not. It's not exactly as if this news is, wait, when you throw a ball, it goes up. It's not that sort of surprising turning our understanding of knowledge on its head. It's a small part of a very large picture that we didn't really know a huge amount about. But now we think what we thought we knew is something different.
Well, the cracks in it are how the light will get in, right? And we'll kind of figure out a little bit more. So what's happening, what they've talked about in Fermilab in the United States is about the magnetic property of subatomic particles called muons. Now, what's a muon? A muon is like an electron, except it's 200 times more massive. So it's like a fat electron. I suppose. And what do they do in the experiment? So they took these muons, which actually have a magnetic property. So they have a north and south pole, like a magnet. And they put the muons into a huge donut-shaped magnet. And they made it wobble. So they looked at the strength of the magnets within the muons by tweaking transient quantum particles. What the hell does that mean, right? So they put the muons into this big donut and they looked at how they behaved under certain conditions. And they were looking particularly at something called a muon magnetic anomaly. So they know when you put muons into a magnet that the strength of their magnetic field is going to wobble slightly. And they reckon they can account for all the quantum particles that contribute to that wobbling. And they made a calculation to say, right, here's all the things we know about and we can account for in the wobbling. So if there's extra wobbling, then that must come from stuff that we don't know about. The outcomes of the experiment did not match the prediction. The prediction would have been what the standard model said. And because of that they're not equivalent, that hints that new physics must be accounting for the difference.
Jessamine, our second story has to do with bacteria.
That's right. It's a really interesting discovery that when it comes to treating malnutrition, it might be just as important to look at people's gut bacteria as the calories that they're taking in. So this is especially important when looking at malnutrition in children. There are 30 million kids worldwide who are suffering from malnutrition. And unfortunately, even once they start getting enough food, their bodies stop wasting and grow the way that they're supposed to, many of them never fully recover. So this story is about researchers from Washington University in St. Louis, as well as the International Center for Diarrheal Disease Research in Bangladesh, who basically were looking for ways to treat not just the calories in, calories out of malnutrition, but also the gut bacteria. So basically, these researchers looked for accessible foods that were relatively easy to get, but that promote what they identified as 15 key bacteria in the gut that are needed for normal growth in children. And they basically compared a supplement which is commonly given to just increase caloric intake for people suffering from malnutrition with their own like microbiota supplement that actually had 20% less calories overall than the standard supplement that's given. And what they found was that actually when these kids were given this supplement 2 times a day for 3 months, the microbiota supplement resulted in twice as much growth rate for the children, which is a huge difference.
Wow.
Right. And something that you kind of wouldn't expect if they're actually getting less calories. Like you would think that that would be the main number that matters. But how the microbiota responds to these calories is actually really important. And just treating, are you getting enough food? It turns out isn't actually enough. So this is a huge result, and obviously it could have massive implications for treating malnutrition worldwide.
The idea that rather than giving more food, you give something to feed the gut bacteria to help it break down food and get the nutrients out of it to grow a child's body, that's pretty significant. Was this a prebiotic, a probiotic? What was the supplement?
So the supplement was a combination of chickpea, banana, soy, peanut flours, and some different oils. It wasn't that different from the standard supplement that's given, but they basically were looking for factors that could then feed these bacteria specifically. I think it's just incredible that you get this large of an effect, even with a lower caloric intake.
Okay, so I misunderstood. I thought they were getting a synthetic sort of or a lab type culture to improve their microbiome. This is just the sort of foods that that feed the good bacteria.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's inexpensive, accessible. And that's one of the things that's great about the way that this study was designed. Now, obviously, there are still some issues around the storage of the supplement that they developed, because you want something that can be, kind of put in a closet for 4 months or shipped all around the world. So that's going to be the next step of this research, is trying to make this into something that can be very widely distributed. But it's really, really promising early work in preventing malnutrition or treating malnutrition in children across the world.
Presumably, it also may have a positive effect on the microbiome of healthy children. We don't know that from the report, and it's always a bad idea to extrapolate. But those foods were chickpea.
Yeah, chickpea, banana, soy, peanut, and just some different natural oils. Okay. So yeah, it's something that has implications for everyone, really. And it kind of goes back to that issue of, how we are in terms of our health and our growth isn't just calories in, calories out. We also really have to look at that gut microbiome. It's extremely important.
Shane, your second story is about dogs.
Yes, my favorite science subject. This is about assistive dogs as well. About their feet, and the study claims that they are positively cleaner than the soles of human shoes, the feet of dogs. So as I said, it's about assistive dogs, and there are 10,000 people in the EU who have an assistive dog. They can be guide dogs for the blind, hearing dogs, medical response dogs, etc. Indeed, I get to walk a guide dog about once a week for my friend. The dog's name is Gaston, if he's listening. He's a lovely little fella. So these dogs are often refused entry to places like shops and hospitals and restaurants, etc. Even though they are allowed to go in, but they're often refused entry because of perceived hygiene issues. So people might think they're bringing dirt in on their paws. And so some scientists in Utrecht decided to do a study on that. And they took 25 assistive dogs plus their owners and 25 non-assistive dogs and their owners. And they all went for a 30-minute walk, and then they swabbed the shoes of the owners and they swabbed the paws of the dogs. And for both assistive dogs and non-assistive dogs, they found that the paws of dogs were much, much cleaner than the soles of people's shoes, particularly for nasty bacteria that can cause infection. So, so let dogs in. That's the bottom line.
When you said these dogs weren't let in, I thought you were going to say it was because they were Irish. So, so why are they cleaner?
Well, one of the theories is that dogs do a lot of grooming. So they'll clean their paws with their tongues, unfortunately, and that will clean all the bacteria off. And I don't know about you, but I haven't seen any people like licking the soles of their shoes to clean them. Indeed, like how often do you clean the soles of your shoes in general? Like all I do is polish the top of them, if that.
Is the take home from this that we should be making shoes out of dogs' paws?
I would think so. And I would imagine significant applications in that area in the near future.
Jessamine, our final story is about making decisions.
That's right. And specifically how we make decisions when we have a lot of different options, right? So people talk about paralysis of choice, you know, in grocery stores and places like that. And times when you have a lot of stuff in front of you and you're probably kind of balancing, trying to make the optimal choice with the time that you might need to find that optimal choice. So researchers from two Berlin universities have actually shown that where we look when making a choice can help predict our choices and can change the values of those choices. So they did this in a study looking at snack food. They recruited about 50 people who like snack food and had fasted for 4 hours beforehand. So it was especially relevant to them. And they basically just showed them panels of 9, 16, 25, or 36 different types of snack foods and just asked them to choose. And when they were doing this, they had an eye tracker that just sort of followed where they were looking on the screen. They did this multiple times and looked at what foods the people chose. And then after the experiment was over, they also asked the same people to rate these different snacks, right? So you'd think here an optimal choice would be, I want to pick my absolute favorite snack food if it's on the screen. Otherwise, maybe, you know, my second favorite or third favorite snack food. But also 36 is a lot of things to look at. So there was one kind of popular proposal that perhaps people would be sort of looking through all the foods in order until they found one that was good enough for the amount of time that they had put in and just go based on that. That's kind of what the researchers were expecting to see, but it's not what they saw. They saw that in general, the more that people looked at individual snacks would indicate what they were more likely to choose. And actually, in more than half of cases, people didn't choose the last thing that they looked at. You know, they weren't just kind of going until they found one that was good enough and then being like, oh yeah, that one, that's fine. They were sort of looking around and jumping more and more as they got closer and closer to making their choice. They would often go back and forth between things multiple times. But in total, the amount that they looked at something was predictive of how they made that choice. So it's something about the actual attention of looking at something which increases its perceived value, even if it's not one of your favorite things, you know, even if you didn't rate it highly in terms of its intrinsic value, which is really interesting.
Is this science able to help me speed up my children choosing an ice cream in the shop?
I mean, you could try to give them fewer choices because they did find that, you know, you spend less time looking at all the different things when you just have fewer choices. Or you could just say, hey, you're looking at that one a lot. Sorry, it's Cornetto for you.
You know, when I go to the US, shops over there have so much choice. Yeah. I wonder, do Americans thus spend an awful lot longer in supermarkets than Europeans do? It's like supermarkets over there, like, you know, you go to the toothpaste aisle and there could be thousands of types of toothpaste.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the interesting things is that, like, this study really showed that people aren't very categorical when it comes to looking through choices. You're not, like, looking at each one being like, that one, no, that one, no. You're kind of just jumping around randomly, and you don't look at all the choices. Like, especially on those panels of, like, 36 snack foods, no one was looking at all 36. They looked at a few, they jumped around some, and then they chose one. So I guess that's like how we get by in America.
It's like finding a wife, I suppose. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from NUI Galway, Dr. Jessamine Fairfield, thanks very much for your time. Now, our first son arrived so easily, it sort of caught us off guard. And we foolishly assumed the second would be the same. But like many hopeful parents nowadays, we endured 2 years of worry, frustration, and sadness until eventually 4 years later, our second son arrived. we were the lucky ones. Fertility rates are plummeting across the world. And if they continue on their current course, assisted fertility and IVF could soon be the norm, not the exception. Professor Shanna H. Swan from Mount Sinai is the author of Countdown: How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. She joins me now. Shanna, that is a pretty heavy title for a book. Let's start at the beginning. And why did you first start looking at this subject?
I got interested in the decline of sperm count when I was working for a national committee that wondered about the validity of a study that had come out of Denmark in 1992. That study also claimed that sperm count had dramatically declined over the prior 50 years. And when I looked at that study, I was quite skeptical. And because I had the time to put in to look at it in more detail, I actually spent 6 months trying to make that decline go away, looking at factors like, has the method of counting sperm changed? Has the kind of men included in the study changed? Are they more obese? Are they more likely to smoke? And so on and so forth. And after that exploration and a new analysis that included all of those factors, what I saw, to my great surprise, that the slope had not changed at all, not to the first decimal place. So I had to start taking it seriously. And then as a reproductive epidemiologist, I asked, well, what's causing this? And is it still going on? And so that began my exploration into this question, which went on until right now.
When you say this slope, what kind of a decline are we talking about?
Well, the decline that we reported in 2017 is the one I'd like to tell you the details about, because it is my study. And what we found was that in Western countries, the decline in sperm concentration between 1973 and 2011, that's 39 years, was about 50%. And the decline was from 99 million sperm per milliliter to 47 million per milliliter.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's really dramatic. And that was over only 39 years, less than two generations.
That is extremely stark. If we've lost 50 up until 2011, and we think now about how the world is more populated, more plastics, more stress, all of the things that we think about may affect fertility are only intensified. It does make it a very pressing concern. When you looked at this decline, was there also a similar decline in fertility in men and in women?
Yes. So fertility, the way demographers look at it, is the number of children that a couple has. And so you're spot on with two, but if you drop below, actually 2.1 is considered replacement. If a country drops below that, then it's considered below replacement and should start being concerned about continuing its population. The Western countries are almost all below 2.1 and more dramatic right now. And that number has dropped between 1960 and now from 5 children per couple or woman to 2.4 worldwide.
Right. But that in itself may be the result of choice rather than issues, right? I mean, certainly there are enough people in the world already. No one can argue with that. And in previous generations, the need to have lots of sons and daughters to basically ensure that a few of them survive and look after their parents in their dotage, that sort of philosophy and culture in Western worlds has changed very much because of the accruing of wealth, right? So
right. We
don't necessarily associate that fertility with biological problems, do we?
Yes and no. So it is true that there are many social issues involved here. Those that you described, also the fact that when a population gets more educated, and women are given a bigger place in the workplace, and contraception is introduced, and all of these things, urbanization and so on, that fertility declines, absolutely. However, we are also seeing that in those same countries, young women are not able to reproduce themselves, as you may have experienced. I just point out that if we look, we are not alone on the planet. And if you look at the myriad of species that have become endangered and are not able to reproduce themselves and do have the same threats that we do in terms of chemical exposures, which I'm sure we'll talk about, they are not choosing, you know, the alligators, the fish, the frogs, they are not choosing to delay childbearing and to have a smaller family. Yeah. This is happening against their will, if you will.
So there are social aspects, but that's only part of the issue. In terms of the sperm count, it's not just that the concentration has gone down, right? There are other factors to do with sperm quality that are also contributing to this issue.
Definitely. And when a man's sperm is evaluated, count is, of course, part of it. Total count, which would be concentration times volume, but also how the sperm are shaped, that's we refer to as morphology, and how they swim, which is motility. And then there's also their chromosomal integrity, if you will, having to do with DNA damage, which is also a serious problem. That said, I have to point out that our meta-analysis in 2017 that showed this dramatic decline that I reported to you did not look at these other factors.
Right.
And that is because it was very important to us that the method used across time, since we're looking at a time trend, the method used stayed constant. And because motility and morphology methods have changed dramatically, while counting methods have not changed at all, we chose to focus on counting.
Right. Okay. In other people's work, though, have you seen changes to motility, morphology, and DNA?
Yes. But nobody has done this sweeping meta-analysis right. for any of those endpoints. That said, these things are correlated. So as you may know that the sperm concentration, you know, being low implies that it's likely that morphology is poor and motility is low and perhaps DNA damage has occurred.
So this is all to do with men. In terms of women of who obviously bear the brunt of childbirth, what's going on with them? Do we see in other people's studies correlations in terms of issues with egg, placenta, fertility in their physiology?
Yes. This is definitely a couple enterprise. Both the man and the woman play into this probably equally in terms of problems that may occur. And we see equal amounts of, if you will, damage to the reproductive function of both the man and the woman. And it's surprisingly, the declines in function appear to be happening at about the same rate in men and women, which is about 1% per year. So miscarriage rates have been going up at about 1% per year. Diminished ovarian reserve, which is the inability to have sufficient eggs as you get older, the quality of the eggs, endometriosis, which is a problem that interferes with pregnancy, irregular menstrual function, and so on and so forth. All of these things are impacted, as in the man, by a number of exposures in our environment.
So this is the key issue, as you identified, the environment. Can you talk to us a little bit about the anogenital distance and why it's of interest?
Yes, you jumped right in to the heart of the matter, so to speak. Let's start with what is anogenital distance. So I don't know how it is in Ireland, but in the US, we have an urban dictionary, and in that urban dictionary, you can look up taint or grundle or gooch, all standing for the same thing, which is the distance from the anus to the genitals, or the anogenital distance, or for short, AGD. So this distance turns out to be very important in this story because it is very sensitive to testosterone in early fetal development, in the womb, right? in the womb when this little organism is developing and the genital tract is developing, if it's going to become male based on genetic sex, then it needs testosterone from the fetal testes to develop normally. And in particular, this distance, AGD, is going to be longer or shorter depending on how much testosterone is present. So that's really key, because when we see a baby after birth, we have no idea what the testosterone was in the womb in the first trimester. But the AGD tells us, because the longer the male AGD, the more testosterone there was, and the longer the female AGD, the more testosterone was. So the female should not see testosterone, not very much. There's very low levels in the females. The male should see a lot to, you know, accomplish this feat of creating the male reproductive tract. So if there's not enough testosterone, then he has changes which will stick with him for his whole life, we believe.
Yeah. So this is something I've never heard. We have the Urban Dictionary. I don't know if we have an Irish word for the distance from the anus to the scrotum, but I'm certainly not going to ask our listeners. But this length is sort of used as a rule of thumb to let us know about the potential health of children. And this is now shrinking. Is that correct?
Not quite. I can't say that it's shrinking overall, because we have no way to know that. There was one early study, and then I was the first person to use it to look at environmental exposures and to actually use it systematically in this kind of study. And that was published in 2005. So before that, we have no data on right. this measure. So, what it does tell us is there are animal studies, and animal studies show over and over again that when the mother is exposed to higher levels of certain chemicals, those that can lower testosterone, because it feeds on testosterone, if you will, it gets bigger the more testosterone. So the lower the testosterone level, the shorter the anogenital distance. And so chemicals in our environment that can lower our testosterone play in here. And in fact, when the National Toxicology Program tests a chemical for its reproductive toxicity and wonders, is it testosterone lowering or is it estrogen increasing? They look at this measure.
Right. So this is the question, I suppose, that will alarm most people. What are phthalates? Where are they found? And why are these plastics of such concern to us when it comes to fertility?
So I guess I'll start with the last question. They're of concern because, as I've just said, anything that lowers testosterone is of concern for reproduction and actually for neurodevelopment too, but we're not going to talk about that today. So phthalates have the ability to lower testosterone. And they do that most strikingly when the woman is pregnant. She is exposed to phthalates. The phthalates are actually water soluble. They get into her bloodstream. They get into her urine. And they're in circulation. They affect the development of the fetus. And by the way, then they go into the urine. And then we can measure them. Because right now you have a lot of phthalates in your body, as do I. Everybody does. 95% at least of the population.
And where do they come from?
Yeah, that's a great question. So where do they come from? They come from any soft, squishy plastic, such as your kids' rubber duckies or toys, shower curtains, water bottles, anything in your environment where you see soft plastic in your kitchen, that's going to have phthalates in it, and they're going to leave the plastic because they're not chemically bound. So particularly if it's heated, the chemicals will come out. So in a warm environment, by the way, they're also in polyvinyl chloride. So any PVC products in your home will have these in them. They're also in cosmetics. They're also in personal care products. They're also in laundry detergent. They're in cleaning products. They are incredibly ubiquitous because they have so many functions.
Right.
So yeah, they make plastic soft, but they also help products retain color and scent. So they're in fragrance products. And they also help absorption, say, through the skin. So they're in personal care products. So you can see that you can't escape these. They're in everything.
So the link between this and testosterone, how strong is it? And if this is of such concern, why are these plastics or this plastic additive not banned?
Well, it is very strong. It is very conclusive. You can show it in a what we call in vitro study in the laboratory. You can just show its action. It's testosterone lowering action by seeing how it looks in an assay that assesses what's called anti-androgenicity. That's one step. Then you can show it in animals, which has been done multiple times. And actually the name phthalate syndrome has been given to the cluster of male, I won't say abnormalities, but changes in the male reproductive tract that's observed. Phthalate syndrome, very unusual to have a syndrome named after a contaminant in plastic, right? And then you have our animal our human studies. So in addition to the animal studies, we have many now populations in which we've shown that phthalates in the mother's urine are directly correlated with the size of the genitals in the boys that are born.
Oh man. Okay, so that is not good. And it sounds largely problematic. Why are we allowing these additives in our plastics if the effect is so clear cut?
Well, the effect has not been clear cut for very long, I have to say. Our first study was 2005. That's not a very long time ago in terms of regulatory speed.
If it's cutting fertility rates by 50% over 40 years, I mean, surely that requires action quicker than 15, 16 years to allow some regulation to come in. I mean, this seems very, very aggressive in terms of how it's affecting fertility.
Yeah. So let me say, this is one chemical that's affecting fertility and one factor. There are many other factors, and I don't know how much time we'll have to talk about them, but this certainly does that. It does act in that direction. Some regulation has taken place. For example, in the United States, we had the Consumer Protection Act of 2008, following our 2005 study. But unfortunately, they got it a little bit wrong because it bans phthalates in children's toys. It doesn't say anything about exposure to pregnant women, which is really what I think should be targeted first. And in the EU, which is much more aggressive about these chemicals, we have a program called REACH. And under REACH, a chemical has to be proven safe before it's put into the marketplace. So many, many things are allowed in the United States that are not allowed in the EU. However, there are limitations to the way things are shown to be safe in the EU and in the United States, which are problematic. So it's definitely a step in the right direction. In the US, manufacturers can put anything they want into products practically. They don't have to prove them to be safe before they're marketed. So we have a long way to go, but I think the whole world has a long way to go.
How do we change our behaviors to mitigate this level of exposure?
I think the people that have to take the first action, the most important people to take action, are people like you, young people who are at risk of pregnancy, men and women at risk of pregnancy, not just the woman, because, by the way, the man is creating sperm all the time, takes about 70 days to make a sperm. So in those 70 days before conception, anything that was introduced into his body could cause changes that would affect the offspring. Okay, so the young men and young women, particularly pregnant women, have to take action. And I think the first thing is to recognize the problem, look about your home, look at phthalates, look at plastics in your kitchen, in your bathroom, look and check on your personal care products by going online and Googling. There's lots of resources online. In the United States, we have something called Environmental Working Group, where you can put in actually a brand name and say, how safe is this product? I think once we're aware that these are risky, then we can start protecting ourselves. By the way, fragrance I mentioned, contains a lot of these chemicals. So fragrance-free, plastic-free, don't cook in phthalates, of course, don't cook in any plastic, don't heat in plastic, try not to store in plastic. Use a HEPA filter because dust contains a lot of these products. We inhale them, we put them on our skin, and we eat them. So try to eat unprocessed food, because unprocessed food will not have been passed through tubing that is soft and flexible that contains phthalates. Okay, so try to eat organic organic unprocessed foods is a big help. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing there, I mean, we heat plastics all the time in microwaves in our house. Food comes in plastics.
No.
This is a stupid question to ask, but you're going to ask it anyway. There are lots of people out there who've taken a cause and they've run with it because of what they see, and they feel very passionate about it. And obviously, I think phthalates and fertility is yours. The question is, how much should we worry about this? Because there are so many things to worry about, but you've made a very compelling case. I'm wondering, is the world behind you in seeing the immediate danger here? Because it doesn't seem to be something that the world is talking about a huge amount when it comes to fertility.
Right. I think this is it's a great point. And first of all, I have to just insert the sentence that it's not just phthalates. There are hundreds in your body, 100 different chemicals right now, and many of them interfere with your hormones. And that's the key, hormonally active chemicals called endocrine disrupting chemicals. There is a major movement in regulation and in the environmental groups to get rid of endocrine disrupting chemicals. It's certainly not just me. I've pointed out and studied for a long time this particular class of endocrine disrupting chemicals, but there are others. There's bisphenol A, there's chemicals in flame retardants, there's chemicals in our Teflon pans, and they just pervade our daily life. The reason it's not talked about, I think, is that this is a very embarrassing topic. I don't know how much you talked about your problems with fertility, and I appreciate that you're sharing them on this, you know, program, but most people, particularly men, are very sensitive to the fact that their testosterone may be lower, which it is going down, by the way, also at the same rate, that they're having problems conceiving. Women are very embarrassed about their repeated miscarriages and their failures to conceive. They blame themselves. The woman is traditionally blamed. So this whole topic is in the closet, isn't it? I mean, we don't talk about this. Mm. This is, you know, we might talk about, oh, I went to the doctor and I had my cholesterol tested and it was a little high and I'm changing my diet. That's safe. You can do that. You're not embarrassed by that.
Yeah.
But you won't go to that cocktail party and say, I had my sperm tested today and boy, was it poor. You just won't do that, right?
Yeah.
So I think that we have to acknowledge that we all as human beings have these issues the same way we have issues with our heart health and our, you know, our body weight and so on. And some people have called this reproductive health as the sixth vital sign, because by the way, and I don't want to scare you with this, but by the way, men with low sperm count or have problems conceiving have more disease, like heart disease, diabetes, and so on, and they tend to die younger. Mm. So it's a signal that your body needs something, you know, and that there's something wrong. And by the way, we haven't talked about lifestyle changes, but many lifestyle behaviors affect these things as well. Your smoking, binge drinking, obesity, stress, diet, all of these things that you worry about for other aspects of your health also affect your reproductive health.
Going on the current rate of fertility loss, I mean, are we looking at a children of men scenario where our grandchildren really struggle to conceive naturally?
I think we are looking at an increasing use of assisted reproduction. And we've already seen that. And that has increased also at about the same rate. So the line that indicates the decline in sperm concentration, if you were to extend it, and I'm not saying that that's a sensible thing to do, but if you were to extend it, it would hit zero in 2045. So one generation from now. And hitting zero is not really possible. And that's because that's the median, the middle sperm count. So half would be negative. And you can't have a negative sperm count. So just mathematically, that curve is going to have to flatten out.
Right.
But the rate at which it does that is really important, because as we get below 40 million per milliliter, we get to the point when it takes longer and longer to conceive a pregnancy. And we're very close to that now.
I knew it was going to be a sobering conversation, but I'd love to hear your comments on it. Professor Shanna Swan, author of Countdown, How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Jonathan.